Hey, loyal Matty P listeners. This is Grim Shea, and welcome to Matty P Presents Saturday Morning Serial. If you grew up any time between 1979 and 1992, you probably remember Saturday morning cartoons. The one day of the week as a student you would have off and you'd scramble out of bed, stay in your pajamas, turn on the TV, pour yourself a nice big bowl of Count Chocula, and dive in for the next 4 hours. Well, we here at Matty P are trying to remember that spirit. So join us, if you will, for this little offshoot called, once again, Matty P Presents Saturday Morning Serials. And for our inaugural episode right here and now, we want to talk about Space Command. You probably haven't heard of it yet, unless you're really in the know, but it will be a big deal eventually. It's filming now. It's a 6-movie-long arc. We don't even know what screen it's going to end up on. It might be a Netflix original. It might go to the theaters. It might go straight through the pay-per-view and the Xbox download route. Time's going to tell, but it's going to be something to keep your eye on. So we've already talked to 3 people involved in this, and we thought we'd bundle together these little interviews, maybe give you an idea of what Space Command is and how it ties into that great forgotten culture when you were just a kid and cartoons and cereal would just take you away into little imagination adventure land. Now, first up, we're going to be sharing with you our conversation with Dean Haglund, who you may know from X-Files and the spinoff, Lone Gunman. He was the tall one. Anyway, without any further ado, I want to dive into that, and then we're going to come back with Mark Zucree and sci-fi movie legend Doug Jones. All right, welcome back. We are in for a special treat here on Matty P Radio Happy Hour. We are going to be talking with Dean Haglund, direct from the set of his new film, The Lady Killers. And without further ado, let's bring him out here. Dean, are you there?
Hey, everybody. I am. How are you?
Well, you're on the line with me, Grim Shea. Joining us, of course, is my co-producer, Mark E. Say hi, Mark.
I cannot believe that we are talking to a lone gunman right now.
Oh.
This is ridiculous. But go on. Yes, I am Mark E. I am so excited that you're here.
Mark E. is the X-Files guy.
And I'm not going to just bombard this interview with X-Files questions. And
hey, go right ahead.
No, it's fine. No, we're going to, I'm sure we'll get to some of it.
No, I'm pulling the reins in on them already.
Go ahead. Continue.
But now, listen, what I want to talk to you about first, and we can talk about it as long as you want, is I know you have just started filming this new movie, The Lady Killers.
Yeah.
And I want you to tell us all about it, because it is hard to find info on it.
Well, yes, we have a Facebook page, and The Lady Killers movie is our website, and it is a romantic thriller directed by and written by Phil Larness, who is my also producing partner and co-host of my podcast of 7 years, the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. So we have been talking for some time about doing another movie. We, of course, did a documentary together and way back when did a Lifetime movie. I think it was called Lost Souls, but when we shot it was called Spectres with Marina Sirtis and Tucker Smallwood. And now we are doing a The Lady Killers.
I not only like the idea that you guys just took off and said, we're going to do this after you've done some work together, but on top of that, now, as I understand, this is a partially crowdfunded movie.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it is currently an underfunded movie. So what I want you to tell us,
you're following
Mark,
our Twitter feed, are you?
Faithfully, but I want you to tell us so we can pass it on to the listeners.
How can we help?
Anyway, how can we do it?
Yes, we have a donate now button at our website. I'll just make sure it's still functioning as a website. You know, when you play a computer hacker on TV, a lot of your websites get
they
hacked.
They suck.
They suck. Well, you know, there's a lot of there's a lot of kids out there who go, hey, is that guy really a hacker? And then, you know, they go at it. on your website.
So you are actually isolated because you were Langley on the Lone Gunman.
Well, it's not that I'm isolated. It's that these they want to see how mad my skills are on the old internet. So they'll
go in. It's make believe, you guys. It's make believe. He's not a hacker.
Well, exactly. And back in '95, I was hand coding my own website. But now I'm not really doing backhoes and all sorts of other nefarious things online. So I get a lot of that action. But yes, the Lady Killers movie. .com. There's a donate now button that you can contribute to the movie, or if you want to go further and become an investor, you can email me directly at dean@deanhagelin.com.
We are all writing this down.
Boy, there's no way not to give you money. Very smart.
Exactly. You'd be ridiculous not to give me money. That's how.
And I like that you're doing it this way. I know Kickstarter gets all the attention nowadays as being the new indie way to fund anything. But was there a reason you chose not to do Kickstarter?
Yeah, well, in fact, we're holding off on our Kickstarter because a movie is really three stages. There's the pre-production stage we are now in the shooting, and then there's the post-production. And if you want, there's also marketing. A lot of young filmmakers think, wow, I've run this marathon, my movie's completed. But in fact, that is just the beginning of the marathon. Once that movie's completed, getting it out there, getting in front of the right people, all of that is a whole nother 26.3 miles of running that you have to do. And so what we've done is we've sort of sectioned off each one of the popular crowdsourcing funding options in sections. So our Indiegogo was actually our pre-production thing. So it was our friends and people in the know and all that sort of thing sort of donated enough money that we could get their people together and then go after investors who then sort of set us up and stabilized us to have the ability to make the movie. And the money that we wanted wasn't so much that it was the complete making of the movie. It just made it to where we got it all in camera, and then we're going to go back to Kickstarter and make a trailer that looks spectacular and then use that for the post-production and marketing end of it. So it's kind of three stages, so you're not just leaning on everybody all at once at the top going, oh my God, we're going to do this amazing thing, like so many Kickstarter things I've donated to that have never come to fruition. You say, oh, I'm going to do this thing. Here, give me $10 or whatever. And then you give them $10. And then, 2 years later, you go, hey, how's that thing you're doing? yeah, I'm still
how's
working on it.
$10 doing? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I've had a couple setbacks, blah, blah, blah. And so, even my Kickstarter where I had a graphic novel, I'm still in the middle of drawing that thing. And yet, all these other projects take me away from it. So, anybody who you donated to my Kickstarter on the graphic novel, that is coming.
Yep, he's just had a couple of setbacks.
A couple of setbacks. I'm doing a movie. Yeah, exactly.
Not a bad one.
Setback. Yeah, it's just it's a time eater. That's all.
So much work, can't get anything done. It's a curse. It's a curse.
It is a curse. Damn them. Damn working.
Well, and I know you do a lot of your work, as you mentioned, with your producing partner, Phil Learness. And and I have listened to the Chilpack Hollywood Hour, a fan
Thank
of the podcast. How did you guys first hook up? I mean, when did you decide, that's it, let's be more than business acquaintances, let's be producing partners?
Yeah, that's a weird question because, we don't actually know the answer to that. When you move to L.A., you sort of just run into the same people at the same parties and the movie theaters and the things. So we don't actually remember, that was the day we met. But he was president of a foreign distribution film company that was distributing, rare French new wave films and stuff like that. And I had rented the office beside it for my production company. And when we come to work every Monday, we would often have an hour-long chat about movies we've seen, events we went to, that sort of thing. And my assistant, who was sitting there on the computer, said, you know, your conversation is very fascinating. You should make that like a podcast. And I went, oh, okay. And then from there, the podcast became this weekly thing where we said, oh, why don't, you know, and it became our production meetings. Basically, we call them on-air production meetings where we talk about future projects and plans. And then it actually became the impetus to start doing actual real films and stuff like that. So it was a real organic, gradual, no focus plan where we go, okay, here's the plan. We're going to do this and this and this. It was just sort of came together sort of really kind of slowly because our podcast has been going for 7 years now, and we never missed a show. Other than last week, we posted Tuesday instead of Monday.
That's nothing.
That still counts.
That's nothing. That, yeah.
It broke my heart, but I've moved on.
We sent an apology on Facebook, and we gave everybody a heads up that was going to happen.
No, I was out of the country anyway. You got lucky that time.
Fantastic.
Now, also what I understand about this movie, The Lady Killers, despite its name, it's actually a very strong female ensemble piece, which is, to put it mildly, a rarity in Hollywood.
It is a rarity. You know, we often talk on our show about the Bechdel test, which is, or Bechdel, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, actually. But it is a graph that determines how many movies that are currently out there have a female lead that has more than 10 lines in the movie, that the conversation is not about the other guy in the movie, and that moves the plot forward. And this test determines basically where, women's role in movies are at. And it has become apparently the lowest ever in the history of filmmaking at the moment.
This sounds like a depressing test.
I know.
Can we just stop doing the test?
Yes, we can. Yes, you can go to a movie and not do the test. But if you're curious about, female roles and the roles, there's so many great, talented female actresses out there that, audition for smaller and smaller parts at lesser and lesser quantities. And so we thought that often we say we should be the change that we want to see. So instead of being angry at the man and fighting, we become the solution that we wish the future to be. So we decided to make a movie that had lots of female roles that were positive, that weren't dependent on talking about what the guy was doing and move the plot forward.
And you got two males to produce it. Well, that's good. One step at a time.
You say two males, but there is some very strong female presence in both our relationships supporting this movie because, it takes an army to make any feature film. And when you see any movie on screen, regardless how bad it is, you just have to doff your hat to the fact that they got it to screen because it is a Herculean effort to get that rock up that hill.
Oh, I believe it. I believe it. And in lieu of asking you anything about upcoming X-File movies, which we are all resigned to the fact they won't be coming, we were excited, especially someone else in this room with me, to be at Comic-Con a couple weeks ago at the IDW panel, which I believe you moderated.
Did you get into that panel, sir?
I did, sir. I did. I used my power as a member of the press, and they actually
got me. No, you did not.
I did. They actually...
Squeezing out poor young girls who only wanted to catch a glimpse of Gillian Anderson.
I offered my laptop.
You said.
Yep. Well, yep. Took up two seats and put his laptop on a third.
As we said earlier, I am an X-Files junkie, and I could talk to you about the cigarette-smoking man, about the black oil, Krychek, of all of it.
Wow.
But one of the things that really kind of stood out, there was I missed the TV Guide panel, which was kind of the big one. It was the 20th anniversary. Can you believe it's been 20 years?
I can't. Well, that is shocking in and of itself. I mean, It seems like it was just yesterday that I was hanging out with all of them, and that 20 years have passed, and I sort of went, oh, geez, I'd better get something done around here. So, you know.
You're damn right. You're damn right. And okay, so I am there at I am there at your panel. I'm excited because I couldn't get into the TV Guide one, and Gillian Anderson is right there, and she looks still just stunning. Incredible.
I know, right?
Right. Like, it's she. She's the same age. It's amazing.
Yeah, like what time machine? What is she eating? Like I could have asked her questions forever about her health regime and diet plan, because it was like it was ridiculous how it was. It's basically 1993 looking at her.
Yeah, and
I didn't understand it at all.
What actually kind of stuck was that, you know, when you finally meet somebody or in the same room with somebody who you've kind of been following for, you know, 20 years now, and when you finally hear them and see them talk at the same time, and when you kind of realize that it is that voice coming out of that person, there was something very kind of spiritual that kind of takes over there. You know, there is that kind of moment where it all becomes real. And that's what your panel brought. So I really want to thank you for moderating that, for taking on that huge challenge of presenting Gillian Anderson to the masses. And I also wanted to give credit to you and the role that you took as being a part of the X-Files, because I believe that X-Files started this geek is chic culture 20 years ago now, but X-Files started it all. Can you kind of touch on that a little bit?
Well, that's fascinating to say, because I actually had a company called Geek Chic, believe it or not. I've closed it down now, it was this thing that the Lone Gunman incorporated, this the power of the nerd sort of thing, that we were, you know, considered weirdos like in season one. But as we progressed through the years, it became that, you know, we had more and more an integral role, and that it was like cooler to come and hang out with us. And then when we got our own spinoff, that was sort of like, oh, you know, now here's the show. And I think that even that show was kind of ahead of its time.
Yeah.
I think that if that show came out now, it probably would have lasted more than 13 episodes.
Yeah.
It sort of seemed that, you know, Chris Carter and all the writers were like, basically, as a surfer does, which Chris Carter, he edited Surfing Magazine for 13 years. He surfed every weekend while doing that show.
He's from LA.
And he goes on these exotic surfing holidays where they boat you out to a barrier reef where a wave appears in the middle of the ocean with nothing around you, and a wave is 3 miles long, and you surf by yourself in the middle of the Bali Ocean, and then a jet ski takes you back to the front. Like, he does this kind of surfing. And
well, that's why we're not getting another X-Files movie.
This guy needs to get off his board.
We've got to take this board.
Yeah, exactly. That's really tough to get back to a laptop when you're doing that.
Yeah.
But he basically, you know, was ahead of the culture curve, like a surfer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and from that
poetic,
from that very same panel, aside from Jillian's voice, I hope I'm saying her first name right. I've actually never heard
Jillian
it spoken.
Jillian is correct, yep.
Okay, good. All right, I got it right. Aside from hearing her sultry voice and finally seeing her, there was a couple things that we learned at Comic-Con at the IDW panel, and we're going to pretend that no one out there heard this yet, okay? But the X-Files lives on, everybody. It lives on. How does it live on?
How? I know, that's the thing. I was shocked to hear this. It is living on in the form of comic books.
Oh my God.
It's called Season 10 X-Files, and it is the IDW's new line that Chris Carter is, I thought he was just calling it in, you know, like he would like look at this some of the sketches and go, yeah, okay.
Kind of George, kind of acting like a George Lucas.
He's actively involved in putting this thing together. And so it's the season 10. It's part of the canon of the X-Files, which I didn't know afterwards until I read all the tweets and everything. But he was being dodgy on that, and I put his feet to the fire and made him say, yes, this is official canon of the X-Files lore. that season 10 comic book is. It's not a different story. It's the actual sort of continuation of it.
Right, right.
Almost better than a movie.
Well, yeah, you know, as a X-Files junkie, we want the story to continue. And it's not really important what that vehicle is. You know, we want to know
right.
what happens. So just from all of us out there, and I speak for all X-Files fans right here.
He does, forcefully.
I make it happen. We are so grateful to, you know, any role that you might have in the future, which brings me to one more thing that we found out at the IDW panel that was moderated by you, that the Lone Gunman, I think they survive, don't they?
They do. How did, what the, you know.
How, I saw them die, kind of. They didn't really, but they kind of did, right?
You never saw them.
Well,
you never
you know,
saw them.
And it's funny, I think I said this at the panel. I might have gave a truncated version of it, but often at these sci-fi conventions when someone would bring up the death of the Lone Gunman, I would often point out that, you know, when we took that horrible virus hit to save tens of thousands of people, it sort of went to a white screen, and then the next shot was three hermetically sealed CDC chrome coffins out at the grave site, and they were all the same size. And with a contaminated virus body, the coffin is supposed to be fitted to the size of the person so that there's no air for that virus to grow. And so if you look at that final scene, all the coffins are the same size, yet one of the gunmen are shorter than the other two.
Oh,
and that was your indication.
Devious bastard.
Is that just some goof by the production manager, or do you think that was planned that way? Or is that just you finding hope here?
Yeah. Well,
I
no, because I had said that at a convention with one of the art directors from The X-Files. He was backstage, and he came up, and he goes, hey, that's a funny story, because, you know, Chris Carter actually said, because we had made one coffin shorter than the other two, because we knew, you know, CDC, and Chris said, make them all the same size.
He planned it. This son of a bitch, he planned it. I knew it.
Yeah.
I knew you guys weren't dead. I was so happy to see it because I did watch that show. I thought that the Lone Gunman was excellent. It was fun, and it kind of filled that little gap when the X-Files started to get a little, you know, a little strained.
Long in the tooth, as we say.
It did. You know, I still watched it religiously, and I was all about it. But you know, it did kind of get a little long, and the Lone Gunman did kind of. It kind of softened it a little bit for us, and it was nice that they gave you guys such a rousing, heroic end, you know. So, you know, you guys earned it. You guys earned your place, like, on this pedestal of sci-fi geekdom, thank you enough.
Well, thank you for that. And and it was funny because I remember distinctly the day I heard I was getting killed off. I was biking down and my phone rings, and it's Frank Spotnitz, and he goes, okay, are you sitting down? And technically, I am. I'm on my bike. And he goes, okay, we're killing you off, but it's going to be a heroic send-off. And I thought, well, that's great, because, you know, we heard the last five or six episodes were coming. It was the end of the show. And I thought, what better way to go than just seeing us sort of walk off into the sunset with a stick and a hobo bag or, you know, something ridiculous like that.
Kind of like a Bruce Banner, in a way.
Kind of like a Bruce Banner. Totally. Yeah. Like a lame-o Bruce Banner ender that they can't figure out. So this was like
kind of goes
a blaze,
on.
A blaze of glory. And we were like, oh, I thought it was great. And I was always very supportive of that whole episode.
And looking at season 10, can you give us? I actually did buy the special IDW Comic Con edition number one X-Files season 10 comic, but I haven't even cracked it.
Signed?
No, I did not get a ticket, but it's fine. Me talking to you is autograph enough, you know. And I'm not going to be. I'm probably never even going to crack it open because I just want to keep this thing pristine. And so, give us a little. You know, have you been able to read the whole series yet, or you know, have you been told?
Yeah,
what's gonna happen?
I was. Before I moderated, they gave me PDFs of the first three.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So if you don't want to crack it, and maybe this interview goes really well, give me a little email. I'll send you a little
PDF. You an email. I'm on that. Thank you so much.
Yeah. He is going to the donate now button as we speak.
That's about a $20 donation if I've ever heard of it.
And go to that donate now button. That's right.
And for all of you out there that are associated with IDW, he did not sell it to me. I am donating. You know, I don't want to get you in trouble.
Exactly.
Okay. No, in fact, if you've got one in front of you, if you just read it to us, that would be wonderful.
That's a whole other show. We're going to have you just read every single
show,
panel.
That's a whole other show, exactly. Page one, panel one. There's the
close up.
Yeah, exactly. It's all dark. Right. So the first episode is they're on a case. Well, should I? Well, no, you're going to read it one day. I'll send you the PDF.
Yeah,
but the second one is where the reveal is of us coming back to life.
Already in the second edition?
In number two.
Let's just get to it.
Two.
Yeah.
They just get to it. And so I think and I talked to Joe Harris, who is a brilliant writer, he's writing like these episodes, and Chris Carter's advising him and stuff like that. And Joe was like, yeah, you know, the gunmen were such a great writing solution when you get into certain, you know, paint yourself into a corner or you are, you know, trapped in a government facility or something like that. The gunman's skills of computer hacking, of surveillance, of all these things is such a brilliant way to get you from plot point A to plot point B easily and convincingly and fun. So.
And we really like you guys. You know, let's not look over that very important fact is that we want to see Lone Gunman. So,
well, you know, it's really amazing. You know, often over the years we heard chemistry, this word, this elusive chemistry that actors strive for when they're on camera with their fellow actors. And when we first started doing The Gunman, I had not met Bruce Harwood, who played Byers, till I walked on set.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like him and I had side-by-side little, not even trailers, we had like these little 4x4 squares with a little sink in there. You know, it's like a tiny little room. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we just started chatting, hey, you know, nice to meet you. And then we go, who's the third gunman? And Bruce says, oh, it's the first AD, the first assistant director. He's going to be reading the lines of Frohickey. I'm like, what?
What
kind of cheap thing is this that they give the assistant director a character? And we find out later that he actually had acting training and that, the director wanted a short, weaselly look like the first assistant director. Like an executive, exactly. So they gave him the part, and then we basically, you know, hung out, and it was so easy having this chemistry with the three of us. It was always a joy to do. There was never friction. There was never ego. There was never anything like that. It was the ridiculously easiest acting role in the history of film or television.
That's only because you were good at it.
I'll take that compliment, sir.
Well done.
Thank you.
All right. Well, before we let you go, because I know you're busy on the set,
yes.
But is there any kind of time frame? I understand you still have three marathons left here, but is there any time frame when we could expect the Lady Killers in theaters?
I'm going to say we wrap shooting August 31st, and the first we're going to take it to film festivals. And so I think we're probably going to Sundance in January. And then from that deal, I'm going to guess if everything goes well from here on in and editing and everything as we envision it comes together, generally a sale in January gets you some sort of springtime 2014 theatrical release.
All right, well, I'm going to put some money in and cross my fingers, and I have total faith in you to get this done, and then we'll just, I'll feel like I'm joining you on the film festival circuit. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. It's going to be great.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us, Dean, and everybody out there. If you cannot get enough of this guy, get the comics. And if you can't get enough of the Lone Gunman out of the comics, listen to the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour podcast weekly every Monday.
And don't forget theladykillers.com. That's where,
please,
you can, that's where you can donate.
We've all got to do our part to get this made.
I want more Dean on the screen. More Dean on the screen. So thank you again, Dean, for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming here. Thanks
and
again.
Thanks for coming to the panel. That's awesome.
Oh, I couldn't. I would have broke into that thing. Don't worry.
Yep. He's got it all recorded if you need a copy.
Take care.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Bye
thank
now.
You, Dean.
Good luck, Dean.
Dean Haglund, very talented gentleman, works on a lot of fronts, very renaissance in the sci-fi world. Now, I'm aware he didn't talk much about Space Command, but he was just to give you a little taste, give you an idea of the direction we want you to expect our cultural arrows to be coming from here on Matty P. Presents Saturday Morning Serial. All right, next up, without any further ado, because he actually is the mastermind, the creator, the god, if you will, of the Space Command universe, and it is fitting to bring him up here, because Mr. Mark Zakrie, writer, director, producer, visionary behind this, was also those exact same things behind some of our favorite cartoons on Saturday morning back in the old days, like He-Man and Super Friends and the Smurfs. I don't know what else could get him a card for this convention, but he's earned it. This is our conversation with Mark Zakrie. Take it away, Mark. Please now welcome a TV writer who probably helped raise you if you were alive in the 80s with shows like the Smurfs, Super Friends, He-Man. Right up through the 90s, he was writing for Star Trek Next Generation, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Sliders, Babylon 5, and he's still going. He still has the super buzzed upcoming Space Command. Writer, director, producer, sci-fi extraordinaire, Mark Scott Zakrie. Mark, are you there?
You bet I am, Grim. Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, you're here with just me, Grim Shea, today. But on behalf of everyone in the Matty P. Radio Happy Hour family, I want to thank you because I know you've got to be so busy. I know you're doing, aside from the Space Command.
Yeah, well, it's great. I just finished doing a book with Guillermo del Toro called Cabinet of Curiosities, and we're doing the 6 Space Command films. So it's a busy schedule, but it's really very gratifying, very, very fun.
Now, there's a bunch of stuff that I want to ask you about, but let's just go ahead
sure.
and get this elephant in the room out of the way. Everybody wants to know more about Space Command.
You bet. Well, for many decades, I've worked exclusively for the studios and the networks. I worked for all the major ones, you know, hundreds of hours of network TV. But I mentor a lot of young people in the industry, and I've been hearing more and more about Kickstarter. And I was very intrigued with the notion of seeing if I could raise money, because I'd never done it before. And a young director named Neil Johnson had moved to L.A. for me to mentor him, and he'd been making low-budget science fiction films back-to-back, all profitable. He made 10 in a row. And we were looking for a project to do together, and I came up with the idea of Space Command, which is it's basically a big epic story that covers 150 years in the future, 5 generations of 3 families as we go out into space, colonize the solar system, and jump to the stars. And so we said, well, let's see if we can raise the money to get this ball rolling on Kickstarter. And we set a target, a 2-month campaign, to try to raise $75,000, and we hit that target in just over 3 days. And we kept going, and we raised $221,000. And now we're in pre-production, and we start shooting in the next few months, and we're going to make 6 films back-to-back to start. And it's very, very exciting.
This sounds like an ambitious plan, but it also sounds like you were pretty validated with the Kickstarter experience.
Yes, and we have more people putting in money now. We have investors who are putting in money, and lots of interest. The Air Force is now officially aboard as one of our partners, and we've got a lot of interest from publishing and comic books and the whole 9 yards. It's really great, and of course I've brought a lot of my friends aboard to act in the project. So you know, Doug Jones from Falling Skies, and Dean Haglund from X Files, and Bill Mumy, who I worked with on Babylon 5, and first met when he was on Lost in Space when I was a kid. and Mira Furlan from Babylon 5 and Lost, and Bob Picardo from Star Trek Voyager, and Armin Shimerman from Deep Space Nine, and Ethan Phillips from Star Trek Voyager. I mean, just it's like a dream come true, and it's so much fun working with these incredibly talented actors, and we have our own studio, our own soundstage and green screen stage, and there's really nothing to stop us, and we have no one telling us who we can hire or not hire, what we can write or not write, so there's no censorship at all. There's no one looking over our shoulders, you know, saying, well, you can't do that because it doesn't fit with our corporate objectives. so there's a really great feeling of freedom. And certainly at this stage in my career, it's very nice to not have to worry about that stuff.
That sounds so liberating, but I'd almost imagine that instead of, you know, just a couple of corporate suits over your shoulder, now don't you kind of feel like you have thousands and thousands of nickel and dime kind of producers behind you?
No, not really, because, you know, 3,000 people, donated to the Kickstarter campaign to give us the $221,000 that got us going. And I view them as my collaborators, my friends and audience. And fortunately, throughout my entire career, my tastes have been very much akin to the audience, the science fiction audience. So I grew up with Star Trek and Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, and then when I was 22, I started writing the Twilight Zone Companion to learn how to write and produce television. So I was literally crawling through Rod Serling's attic when I was, you know, a kid in my early 20s, and so that's how I learned my craft. And ever since then, if a story interests me, I generally find that my audience is entertained and interested as well. So I don't view them as adversarial at all. And quite frankly, you know, even with the studio and network executives, I've been very lucky in my career. Usually they were very intelligent. They were very creative. I didn't have a lot of heartache from the studios and the networks. I just recognize that they have different objectives. And particularly with Space Command, I really wanted to tell a hopeful vision of the future. It wasn't, you know, sugar-coated or rose-colored, but it was definitely hopeful where, you know, like the original Star Trek, you know, a lot of people became scientists, a lot of people went into charitable work and so forth because Star Trek said you can create a better future, you can create a better world. And as much as I like shows like Battlestar Galactica, and I certainly enjoyed Oblivion and Elysium and all of these other, you know, other science fiction adventures, they're very dark. And with Battlestar Galactica, as much as I liked it, you know, I always felt, well, can't someone just have a birthday party or something? I mean, like, you know, everything was so, it was all grim. So I knew that the studios were looking for very dark kind of stories, networks as well, and that wasn't the road I wanted to go down because in my own life and the life of people I know, you know, compassion and kindness and love are very positive powers in the world. They're a counterweight against all the evil and darkness and chaos. And I think if you just tell a story in which chaos and hopelessness win, I don't think you're really being truthful to the world that we're living in. So I wanted to tell a very different kind of story.
Well, I like it, just on the limited amount that's up already on the internet, get a real like a throwback vibe to like Star Trek the originals. Also the further franchise, which always had that hopeful beat, I think that you were talking about. And I even see it in the tagline about it being bold adventures, and I just that grabs me. I like that.
Thanks. Well, yeah, and that doesn't mean that there's not going to be danger and warfare and villainy. You know, of course. So, I mean, anytime humanity goes anywhere, they bring those ills with them. You know, with us. And so I'm definitely not going to be sugarcoating that. But I really think that. That giving people an option in terms of a positive future is a good thing. And certainly when I look at space exploration, when I look at, you know, the possibility of us going out to Mars and the outer planets, whenever I hear about a possible manned mission, you know, even what the SpaceX guys are talking about, I'm thrilled. So I kind of wanted to go down that road myself.
I applaud your vision, and I really applaud your business model. I'm rooting for this to work out for you. I love the idea of these new Kickstarter movies. In fact, just the other day, I was talking to Dean Haglund, who you mentioned, also from the cast, who just started production on his own, at least partially crowdfunded movie as well. And he talked about, you know, I think he referred to it as being like running three marathons between the pre-production, production, and then you get your post-production. So are you allowed to go back into Kickstarter with various phases of the production?
You can, but you know, you have to be careful of that because you want to basically prove that you're following through on the promise you made. And so, for instance, since we haven't started shooting yet, we're shooting in the next few months, you know, now wouldn't be the time to go back. You know, down the road in post-production, perhaps, once we've shot and we can show some scenes and some special effects footage and all of that, you don't want to risk alienating, you know, your backers or your audience. You want to keep faith with them. And I'm very aware of that. And I've reached out to a lot of, for instance, our effects team, our visual effects supervisor is Jeff Mark, and he comes off Battlestar Galactica and Serenity. I mean, Ian McCaig, who's our character designer, designed Darth Maul and Queen Amidala, and now he's working with JJ on the new Star Wars film. So basically, I've reached out to the most talented people I know to work with on this project because my goal is to do something, you know, at the top of my game, to do something as of a quality the same as if I were working for a network or a studio. So I'm very aware, when you said it's a marathon, it is, and I'm very aware that I have to really deliver on the promises that I've made. So at some point we may go back to Kickstarter, but not yet. Now we're involved in the specifics of budgeting, building our sets and building our infrastructure and then shooting. And our goal is to shoot the first three films back to back and then do the next three. I've written the first four screenplays and I've outlined films 5 and 6. So, you know, we're right on track right now. Because basically Space Command, although it's designed as a series of features, it's really essentially a TV series. The first 6 hours, which are six features, the 12 hours of the first six features could be 12 episodes of a season. And so how it rolls out in terms of whether it's, you know, 2 hour episodes or 1 hour episodes, it will depend mainly on the platform that shows it, you know. So those are conversations we'll have down the road. But we certainly don't need to walk this into studios at this stage. So the plan is to shoot it first and then figure out what the best distribution model is. One of the things that's great about this project is this amazing serendipity. For instance, during our Kickstarter campaign, you know, I titled the film, the series Space Command, but I was unaware that there was a real Space Command, that the space-going arm of the United States Air Force is actually called Space Command. So during the Kickstarter campaign, I got a call from the Space Command, the real one. And I thought, oh, you know, they're going to ask me to change the name. But no, not at all. They said, we love what you're doing. We want to be part of this. Well, that's very cool. And so, the Defense Department, we filled out some paperwork, and the Defense Department okayed it. And when we went to Comic-Con and had a big panel at Comic-Con a few weeks ago, there was an officer from the Air Force, Master Sergeant Stegner, was on the panel with us. And he was in his uniform with his medals. And when he got out of the car at Comic-Con, everyone was going, you know, great costume, man. And he was going, you know, this is a uniform. But it's great because they don't have story approval, but they very much approve of what we're doing. And so they're providing resources and advice. And I'm going to Vandenberg in a week to get a tour. And then I'm going there for a launch a week later. So this is great experience, and it really helps make the film even better. I'm very open to what the world brings me on this project. So far, it's all been good.
Oh, it sounds great. You already get to go to a base and watch a launch. So if nothing else,
yes,
the kid in me says you won. You can cash in and go home right there.
Yes.
But the rest of us actually are looking forward to this. I mean, and I can't believe that, you know, for $250,000, you're going to make 6 hours of this entertainment.
Well, it allows us to. Basically, we're building it like when I'm the only writer who wrote for both Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5, and I study the production models of those shows. And with Babylon 5, what was done was they rented a warehouse in the San Fernando Valley, converted it to a soundstage. They had the offices there, they had the sets there. They basically never left the building. All the exteriors were computer generated. And so the model that we're embracing, we actually just finished producing two features back to back. My producing partner, Neil Johnson, did a film called Starship and then the sequel, Starship Rising. And my wife and I are producers on those films. And it was basically a test run for what we're doing with Space Command in terms of just logistics. And so we had our warehouse and our soundstage and the whole nine yards. And then we put everything into storage. And now we're going to be renting a warehouse twice as large. And and start building our sets. This is going to happen within the next few weeks. And so the money really gave us that start. And then I think people will step up to invest more as we go. And fortunately, you know, I wouldn't have ever taken this, you know, 10 years ago because, or 15 years ago, because you would have had to shoot on 35 millimeter. You would have needed to edit on a moviola. You would have needed a studio or a network to reach millions of people. Now you don't need any of that. You can shoot digitally. You can edit on a laptop, you know, and with the internet and downloadable content and all of that, you don't need a studio or a network to reach the world. And so that's what really gave me the incentive to do this in this way.
Oh, it sounds, again, exciting. And I am praying that this works out and that it lands on some platform. And within the next couple of years, who knows what the best platforms are going to be anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because even before we shot the first frame, I don't even know if you can use that phrase anymore, but even before we started shooting on Space Command, a lot of distributors have approached us, and we have turned them down at this stage because we don't need them at this stage. And we basically, what our plan is to shoot Space Command and then see who we want to partner with. And it's great, again, to be in that position. So definitely it's going to be downloadable. Definitely it's going to be Blu-ray and DVD. But in terms of if we also have a studio or a network or a web platform like Yahoo or Netflix or Hulu or you know, someone like that, that remains to be seen. But in a way, it's almost like we're kids in the candy store because, you know, we pretty much have, so far, you know, we've had our choice of whatever we want. And that's a wonderful position to be in. And, you know, but mainly at the end of the day, I'm writing this for myself and for my audience, and that's also why I'm directing and producing. And my wife, Elaine, who is also a writer, producer, and director, she's directing and producing with me as well. We've worked together for many years, and that's just great. And so, you know, I just can't. Well, it's funny, when we were getting ready for Comic-Con, we actually got some of our actors on the green screen stage, and we put them in costume and makeup, and we shot scenes with them, and also on some of our sets. You know, same lines, and it was very fun to go to Comic-Con and show some of this footage, including special effects footage of the ship and so forth. And the response was great. It's very funny. We took questions, and the first question was, "Can you show that reel again?" And so we showed it twice at the panel. So I think that was a good sign. And but it's just, I mean, my God, the people I'm getting to work with, it's a dream come true.
I mentioned earlier, we got to talk to Dean Haglund recently, and
yes,
also to Doug Jones about the same time, and
guy.
Both of them were gushing about this production. They couldn't give us any other specifics, but I cannot wait to see it. Well, I'll be honest, I think Netflix would do for me. If it's going to be six movies,
yeah,
I'm a back-to-back kind of guy.
Yeah, I know, me too. And, you know, it's very fun because with Doug and with Dean Haglund, the way I got them involved, it's been so organic. I was nominated for the Saturn Award a couple of years ago. I actually won it. And I was at the event, and I saw this very tall, thin man wearing this amazing jacket. It's sort of this steampunk Victorian-style jacket. I went up to compliment him, and it was Doug Jones. And I mentioned that I was writing a book with Guillermo del Toro. And Doug, of course, played Pan's Labyrinth and Abe Sapien and Hellboy. And we started talking, and we became friends. And then I wrote a role specifically for him. He plays a character named Dor Nevin, who's what we call a synthetic, basically a replicant, an android. And he has an amazing role in these six films. And then with Dean Haglund, Dean had a podcast and he interviewed me, and I thought, well, he's quite wonderful. And I asked him if he'd like to have an acting role in Space Command. And he said, sure. And so I called him and I said, well, what kind of role would you like? What haven't you played that you'd like to play? And he told me, and I thought, okay, I know what I can do with him. So it's just, it's so wonderful to just meet these incredibly talented men and women too. Mira Furlan, who played, you know, who starred in Babylon 5 as Delenn. The way I got her for Space Command was I met a young actress named Yelena Mirja. I have to get the pronunciation right. She's in her early 20s, and she speaks Serbo-Croatian. And I remembered when I wrote for Babylon 5 that Mira spoke that, and I thought, well, they can play mother and daughter, and when they're in space in their ship, they speak Serbo-Croatian to each other, but when they talk to everyone else, they're speaking English. And so I contacted Mira, and we had lunch, and I told her what I had in mind, and she said, I'm in, I'm aboard. And so that was, again, just terrific. And most recently, she was on Lost. She played the character Danielle, who's sort of the crazy French lady in the jungle. And she's just a phenomenal actress. And so it was really great, and I think people are going to love the role that she plays in Space Command. Very unusual role, very different from what she's played before. So it's going to be, and I can't wait to start shooting.
Well, here's hoping that starts very soon. I know you finally got all the casting. You've got enough money to go now. I know you've got more than enough of this huge story arc, it sounds like, which I, as a fan, really appreciate. I like when I have confidence in the creator going in that we're going to see a full story, not a great beginning and then questions.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the problem I've noticed with a lot of TV shows, where they'll start and they really haven't thought it through, and so it peters out. It might have a great initial notion, but then they can't sustain it. But you know, when I worked on Babylon 5 and a lot of shows I worked on, you know, we'd lay it out. I mean, Joe Straczynski certainly knew where he was going for the five seasons of Babylon 5, and so definitely with Space Command, that's why I spent the better part of a year actually writing, you know, the first, you know, six storylines in the first four screenplays, so I knew who the characters were and where they were going. And because, again, you don't want to have a good promise but not be able to pay it off. And so so I really, you know, took the time to learn what I was doing. And I think that'll definitely show. Once we start shooting, I think it'll be very clear that we know what we're up to.
Well, as a sci-fi fan, I thank you for that, then, that kind of depth and, you know, knowing that there's going to be fully fleshed out ideas. And you say, like, over 150 years, that should probably satisfy me. Well, and I won't push you any more about that. Again, I know I'm probably taking up a lot of your time.
No, it's fine.
Mentioned your wife, Elaine, earlier, though, and I know you guys operate the Super Mentors program together.
Yes. We do. Well, you know, I feel a strong obligation to give back, because so many people were so kind to me at the beginning of my career. You know, Theodore Sturgeon and Richard Matheson and George Clayton Johnson and Harlan Ellison, all these great writers from Star Trek and Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, you know, who I grew up watching. And so I started by running a round table of writers and directors and actors and producers. Elaine and I run it. And it grew to thousands of members. It's still going strong. But some of those people wanted us to mentor them more hands-on. And so we started a class where it's 10 students for 6 weeks, and we also teach it long distance. And we just kind of say, okay, what are your goals? What do you want to accomplish? And then we just give them actions to take. And amazing things have happened. So it's really gratifying to see people really take that on. Because in my career and in the careers of many of my friends, I've seen that the people who succeed are the people who are just really, who persevere, who are really determined to get somewhere. And I don't use the word talent very often, because I don't think it's mainly about talent. I think it's mainly about determination, you know, and craft. And so I'm really happy to have helped so many people, and that's still going strong. So I feel a very strong sense of calling in that area. And so I was very lucky, because I knew I wanted to be a writer from when I was a kid, and then I followed in the footsteps of great people. Ray Bradbury was also one of my mentors. We lost him last year, but he was a dear friend, so I try and pass it on. I'm glad that I can, because I think a lot of people can get very lost in Hollywood, and they can feel it's a very cold and hard place. And I think there's two Hollywoods. I think there's sort of the materialistic, awful Hollywood, and then there's a Hollywood of very decent, good people who are creating, you know, artwork of merit, and who have good hearts, and who are family people, and decent straight shooters. And I think you can be part of either Hollywood, but you have to choose to which Hollywood you're going to be part of. And so I help kind of guide people down the path that I think is the most rewarding. And so that's been just quite wonderful to do. And then it also allows me to meet such wonderful people and work with such wonderful people. And I mean, you know, when you mentioned Doug Jones and Dean Haglund, I mean, these are dear people. And Bill Mumy, you know, who I first saw in Lost in Space. I mean, these are really solid, good human beings, you know. And they're not just fun to work with; they're just fun to be with. And one thing about the way I sort of organize my career and my life, I'm not arrogant about this. I come to it with a great sense of humility and gratitude. And so I'm not hierarchical in that way. If I meet someone who's just starting out, I don't treat them as less than, for instance, myself. You know, I'm still growing, I'm still learning. And I'm going to treat everyone equally. And there's no pecking order in the round table that I run, in the classes that I teach, in the set. You know, I mean, I treat everyone the same with respect. And it just makes for a better world and a better life.
Thank you for letting us all know, first of all, about the Super Mentors program. And I don't know if this offer goes out to everybody, but Mark did issue me a personal invitation to the roundtable
Well, it's basically as people contact me, and you know, often I let people come to the table. I mean, it's very much a community that we've created. And for the Super Mentors classes, people can go on to supermentors.com and look that up. And for Space Command, it's spacecommandmovie.com and Space Command Movie on Facebook. And so I can be reached and pretty much anywhere. And I'm happy to hear from people. I always really enjoy it.
And I just want a couple more minutes, just as a fan now, to ask you a couple questions. Because I wasn't kidding about the, back in the 80s, some of those simple morality lesson cartoons that I think probably have done a good job of keeping me from killing anyone or living in jail or anything. Stuff like the Smurfs up to Super Friends. Everybody's a Super Friends fan. And you did on top, and also the He-Man serial cartoon, which I think in the end, I like the cartoon more than the toys, and I had a lot of the toys.
Sure. Oh, wow. That's fun. Well, you know, I was in my early 20s when I started writing for animation. As soon as I got out of college, I knew I wanted to be a writer-producer working in TV. So I started writing The Twilight Zone Companion when I was 22, and by the time I was 22 or 23, my friend Michael Reeves, who was an animation writer, had brought me into animation. So I started writing. The first thing I wrote was a show called, I guess it was Space Stars Finale, which starred Space Ghost. And then I wrote Smurfs and Little Boons and Real Ghostbusters and all those other shows that you mentioned. And so I was sort of the god of animation for the first, 5 or 6 years of my career. And then I jumped over to live action with Next Gen and DS9 and all those shows. But I learned my craft in animation. And it was very funny because people used to ask, are you writing with the children in mind? And I said, I'd always say, no, I'm writing for the child in myself. So I would write to entertain myself. I'd write to entertain myself, and then it would entertain the audience. But I was never writing down to the audience. I was always writing, the best I possibly could. And the funny thing was that often on those shows, they hadn't made them yet. So, for instance, when we were hired to write for Smurfs, they hadn't shot any of it yet. So the creators of the Smurfs, they were actually called the Schtroumpfs in Europe, Pale and Delaporte, flew in to Hanna-Barbera, and all of the writers sat and met with them and asked a whole bunch of questions about the Smurfs. And the same with He-Man. With He-Man, it hadn't been animated yet. So we, read materials on He-Man. They hadn't made the toys yet, I don't believe. And so we just sort of, started from a cold engine. But that was exciting. With Real Ghostbusters, the movie had been made. And so we just basically said to ourselves, well, we're just going to be writing sequels to the movie. Again, we weren't writing down to anybody. We were writing, things that were just really fun and just exciting for us to be working on. So I had a great time writing in animation. And I've written for a lot of shows that I've really, really enjoyed writing for. And I'm very gratified that the shows I wrote for meant something to the people who watched them, whether they were children or adults. And it's great, 20, 30 years later to still have people come up to me, on a daily basis, commenting on the shows I worked on. And that's really a great honor.
Well, consider me one of them because, I love the way it looks like your career sort of matured along with a lot of us in this generation. Because I think by the time I was done with cartoons, I remember being, more or less a young adult and watching Star Trek The Next Generation with my mom on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And then it just got a little darker.
Yeah.
And now I guess we're all ready for the super grown-up idea of Space Command. And I love it that it's going to harken back.
Yeah, well, I think as people grow up and have families and really sort of see what the life's about, they come to understand how important it is to reach out to others and create something loving and compassionate. And I think Space Command, I think a lot of people in their teens and early 20s tend to be a little bit darker and more cynical and a little more nihilistic. But as they actually build lives, they start to come around to a more charitable view of the world. And so I'm glad that I'm now creating something that I think, I feel sure actually the audience will embrace and really value. So I'm very lucky that, I learned from Twilight Zone, and those are certainly morality plays and Star Trek, the original show. I mean, I learned on the, from some of the great writers, and they were writing very moral stories. And, so I'm just continuing in the tradition that nurtured me. I feel very lucky to be writing Space Command and directing it and producing it. It's going to be, the next year is going to be filled with really great experiences, and I can't wait to finish the first few films and share them with the world.
And that's what the world is looking forward to.
I'm glad. I'm very glad.
All right. Well, since we're just going to go into the Twilight Zone, I'm going to ask right now, and I've heard this story, I think, a couple of times through the Hollywood blogosphere, but legend has it that you wrote a spec script for Mad Men, which has yet to be produced, with Rod Serling in it.
That's right. Well, you know, every few years, those of us who write for television have to write new sample scripts, and usually, you know, it's a good idea to write a sample for a show that you're not necessarily even a writer on, but that it's a show that the executives at the studios and the networks watch and know. And I was watching Mad Men, and I really liked that show. And again, because it took place in the early 60s, I knew a ton about that period because I'd written The Twilight Zone Companion. I'd researched, you know, very deep into the late 50s and early 60s. That book was 5 years of research and writing. The Twilight Zone Companion. And so I had this interesting idea of, well, what if when Twilight Zone ended, you know, the Mad Men characters tried to get Rod Serling to be a spokesperson for the companies they represented for their commercials, because Rod, of course, became one of the great commercial spokesmen of all time. And I thought it was a natural, very natural tonally, because when Twilight Zone ended, Rod tried to get the show set up at ABC under a different name, and it didn't succeed, and it was a very dark period for him, a very depressing time, and it seemed, so Don Draper and Rod Serling seemed like a match made in heaven. So I wrote the script, and if anyone wants to read it, it's on my website, markzickrey.com, and you can just go onto that website and pull down the script and read it, and I was very pleased with how it turned out. It was really very, very fun, and of course, I have access to recordings that Serling made. Rod taught a class in writing here in L.A. in the early 70s, and these were not broadcast. They were totally candid. And so it was like being a fly on the wall for how Rod Serling really talked when he wasn't on camera. And so he was actually his vocabulary was a lot saltier than what you'd hear on Twilight Zone. And he was very earthy and just a great guy and very self-deprecating. And so the Rod that I wrote in Mad Men, I think, was a very accurate representation of what Rod was like. And I'm just very pleased that I got the opportunity to write that. And I know Matt Weiner, who's the creator of Mad Men, and so he and I had conversations about this script. I was glad that he didn't mind me sort of, you know, trespassing on his turf a little bit. But for anyone who wants to read it, can certainly read it and enjoy it.
Oh, it's a great script, and I think you paint him as a very Mad Men character too.
You're
probably very right. The kind of that tragic, successful angle. Let's just pretend we've got a little fantasy going here where Matt calls you up and he says, "We're going to make the show. Who do you think should play Rod Serling out of today's crop?"
That's a really interesting question. You know, I thought about it, and someone I think who could be really good playing Serling, oddly enough, would be Sam Rockwell, interestingly enough. Mm. He's because, you know, Rod was actually short. He was only about 5'5". So he was actually diminutive, and most people don't realize that because of the camera, you know. But I think he has the intensity to play it. I think there's a number of actors who can play Rod very, very well. And the trick, of course, is to not fall into just doing an imitation, but actually, you know, embracing the person. And Sam Rockwell is certainly a terrific actor.
I think you could be right there. And he had a kind of quiet intensity during all those intros.
Yes, clearly.
The creative aspects that went into that show, I mean, so many of those plot lines are being repeated and rehashed over and over. They become, you know, tropes in entertainment culture now.
Yes. And the interesting thing is that Rod died at 50. And he didn't really know that Twilight Zone was going to live on, that it was going to become this huge classic that it became. So at the end of his life, he felt that he really hadn't succeeded, that his work was going to be largely forgotten. That's the one sad thing about Rod's life. But at least Rod was very, very successful. He earned 6 Emmys, you know, an amazing run. And thank God he worked in a medium that was preserved, so we can enjoy Twilight Zone now with as much fidelity even more so than when those episodes were originally aired. I mean, it's phenomenal that when they were aired initially, they were on and then they were gone. You couldn't own them. You couldn't watch them whenever you wanted. I mean, I think we're very, it's a great gift to have them where we can watch them anytime we want to. It's funny, for the Blu-ray, I produced the Blu-ray set, and I recorded 52 commentaries. So if you ever want to hear me talk for 30 hours straight, you can just, put that set on the TV. But it was amazing to revisit that material after all these years and just see just how phenomenal that show still is. It's an amazing show.
Well, you're really talking up your Twilight Zone chops here. So I think I'm going to put you on the spot. And now, since you literally wrote the book on this, I'm going to throw you three episode titles, and I want you to just real quickly give me a recap or somehow let me know that you know exactly what episode I'm talking about.
Sure.
Yeah. All right, and we're not going with the easy ones, not Nightmare at 20,000 Feet or Eye of the Beholder.
Uh-huh.
All right, first one is, and this is just a fun title, no matter what the episode's about, The Brain Center at Whipple's.
Yes, that's a fun episode about automation, and it stars Richard Deacon, who was on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and it's about a worker who's replaced by a robot, and it's actually one of the two Twilight Zone episodes that has Robbie the robot from Forbidden Planet, because Twilight Zone was shot at MGM, so Rod had access to every prop, every costume, every set, everything made for any MGM movie ever made. And so pretty much everything that was built for Forbidden Planet turned up in Twilight Zone one way or another. And it's really fun to see Robbie the Robot used in that episode. It's a fun episode, very fun.
Well, it sounds scary too, but all right. You've convinced me. I'll give you that point. You've got Brain Center. All right, now here's number two. Caesar and Me.
Yeah, that's an episode starring Jackie Cooper, who was a child star at MGM, interestingly enough, in the 30s, and then he went on to play Perry White in Richard Donner's Superman movies with Christopher Reeve. And that episode, it's one of the two episodes that Twilight Zone did about ventriloquists, and it's basically about a ventriloquist who's led into a life of crime by Little Caesar, his dummy. And that was actually written by the producer, William Flug's secretary, and it was the only episode of Twilight Zone written by a woman. So it's remarkable in that way.
Oh, all right. Well, you know what? I'm going to give you that one, too. Though I would also have accepted Creepy Ventriloquist episode. That would have been enough for me. All right. Now I'm going to throw you one more, and I know you're batting 1,000 so far. But with a name like this, I don't think you would have to know exactly what it is. There's no way you can bluff your way through it. Here we go.
Sure.
The Seventh is Made Up of Phantoms.
Yeah, that's another Rod Serling script. It's basically about a modern tank crew, military tank crew on maneuvers who are at the Little Bighorn, and they find themselves back in time pursuing the journey of Custer leading up to Custer's massacre. And it stars Warren Oates, who, of course, is known from a lot of TV shows and movies. And it was a fifth season episode. And again, you can see that Serling had these amazing ideas where, who would think to put a modern tank traveling through time to the Little Bighorn? But Rod certainly thought that way. So it's a very fun episode, a very entertaining one.
All right. Well, I'm going to, against my better judgment, I'll give you that point, too. It sounds like you know what you're talking about. Though I actually haven't seen that one, so it's hard to say.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. I want to thank you again for your patience and your involvement. Everybody, please keep your eye out for Mark Zakree. He is going to bring you, and I and all of us, Space Command in the future, and you will thank me for bringing it to your attention. I can almost guarantee it. If you want to know more, you can actually find the original Kickstarter video pitch on YouTube under the Space Command preview. It's great overview. It'll give you an idea of what you're in for. There's even some really good mock-up effects already on there, and that's a couple years old, I think, right?
Yeah, about a year old, yeah. But we're generating even new stuff. If you go on the Space Command website, you can see the reel that we showed at Comic-Con just a couple of weeks ago, and it's got footage of our actors, new special effects stuff. It's a lot of fun.
So get on there, people. Buy a poster. Buy a lunchbox. Your money is going to a good cause on this one. I'm going to let you go on this, but I just want to say on a personal note, thank you for the show Dark Star.
And everyone listening, those little toys with the little lighter inside of their chest and the glow-in-the-dark weapons, that's what they are. I know you're going to forget right after you hear this, but thank you for Darkstar, sir. Thank you for all your contributions to sci-fi, and I am looking forward to Space Command.
Well, thanks very much. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Once again, Mr. Mark Scott Zachary, the man who was working 6-7 days a week just to give us our little kitty crack on Saturday morning. So I think we owe it to him to check this out. I definitely will. I'm getting more and more excited talking about it. And you know what else here on Matty P Presents Saturday Morning Serial has got us all worked up this week is our last interview, our last conversation we're going to share with you from Mr. Doug Jones. The name might not ring a bell, and hell, quite honestly, the face might not either. But this man has been in a lot of the movies you've seen and a lot of the movies that you rightfully love. He was literally everybody cool in Pan's Labyrinth. He was Silver Surfer. He's been in the Hellboy movies. He is Guillermo del Toro's go-to monster man. And if that's not credit for your work, then I don't know what is. He is also joining the cast, or has joined the cast, of Falling Skies in the role of Cochise, again, as an alien, heavily made up, but definitely helped turn that series around. All right, that's enough blathering on. You're going to hear all about it, talking to Doug Jones, who is also a very big fan, as well as one of the big co-stars in the upcoming Space Command films. Take it away. I want everyone to please welcome a man who has enough IMDb credits to buy a boat. He's the star of Hellboy 1 and 2, Pan's Labyrinth, Falling Skies, John Dies at the End, and many, many, many more. The Silver Surfer himself, Mr. Doug Jones.
Ho, ho. Doug Jones, hey, thank you. You know, and with an introduction like that, I really wish you could buy a boat with IMDb credits.
I always figured that's how it worked.
I do. Right. Just bring your laptop with you, and you're ready to go.
Oh, I'd wear them like badges if I had any. Well, listen, before I hope this doesn't set the wrong tone, but before we get going, first, you're on the line with me, Grimshay. I've got Mark E., and Rico is out on the other coast listening in.
Hello.
Hey, everybody.
And I just want to say we talked to Connor Jessup, your co-star from from Falling Skies yesterday, and
yes,
he asked us to ask you,
uh-oh,
and I quote, "Can I cup?" Now, did we just fall for a prank?
Yeah. Did he just burn us? What is "can I cup"?
Now, that sounds horrible when you don't have context.
Well, please put some context in this, because we think it's a joke.
We just don't want to be
alone. Oh, my gosh. I wish he would have added your face on there, because that would have cleared things up.
Oh, he may have. I don't know. I was taking shorthand notes.
Right. Well, can I cup? Here's what happens. When I'm in my full Cochise makeup and alien costume on the set of Falling Skies, I'm a bit of a fascination for all the kids on the show, because I'm a life-size plushy toy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So all of them, and of course Connor's just 19 years old. Last year he was 18, and then of course little Maxim Knight plays little Matt. And so whenever I'm talking to the kids, I'll pet them on the head and say, "You're such a good puppy. Can I cup?" And I'll put my hand on their face, and they'll just kind of lean into it. So that's something that Connor has taken a liking to, and I can't believe he mentioned that on the air. Thank you for that.
Well, that's I feel a lot better. Imagination.
Okay, I feel like I have a dirty mind.
We all do.
We all just wanted to get that out of the way real quick before we get into the real nitty-gritty interview here.
Good. All right. So good. I think we're all still on good terms here, so let's just carry on.
Yeah, we're all good. No one's going to jail.
Yeah. Yeah. Good, I think that's all been explained away.
Not yet. It's early.
Now, you seem to be Guillermo del Toro's like go-to creature guy, kind of like the Andy Serkis to his Peter Jackson. And I'm just fascinated on how, like, a partnership like that can evolve.
Well, me too, honestly. I never in my wildest dreams thought that I would find a director of his caliber that would take me under his wing like he has and groomed me like he has. We met for the first time in 1997 on Mimic, which was his first American feature film with a big budget and a studio attached. So he had quite a reputation in Mexico before that, and had, his first feature film, Cronus, was already out by then, but a lot of American people didn't know that, so including me. So when I met him, I was called in to do some reshoots on Mimic, just to work 3 days as one of his Long John Bug guys. And it was during one of our lunch breaks that he sat and talked to me and asked me all about my history and what have you been in before? Tell me everything. So he's very inquisitive, and he had the kind of inquisitive mind that would accompany a fanboy or an 8-year-old boy. You know what I'm saying? Like he's got such a childlike quality about him, and such a love for creepy, crawly monster things that that he loved hearing my whole resume and asked me if I had a card. So I did. We did that exchange, and then I didn't hear from him for 5 years. I went on and did other jobs. And in 2002, he was prepping the first Hellboy movie, and they had sculpted a maquette of the Abe Sapien character. And everybody at the Spectral Motion Creature Shop said, you know, this kind of looks like Doug Jones. And then he said, Doug Jones, I know Doug Jones. And he pulled my card out of his wallet 5 years later. So that's the kind of...
You don't need no stinking Doug Jones.
That's right.
If you said that.
Well, that's a good argument for getting good quality cards.
Vistaprint.
There's our lesson for the day.
Right. Go on. Well, that's a stroke of luck, I think, for all of us that he still had your card and that you got your foot in that door so squarely,
and that you've stayed so busy. I have my computer here. Jack Nicholson, under his acting credits, he has 75 titles. You have 113 titles. Oh
well,
my gosh! So
now
you are better
for that. Jack Nicholson probably wouldn't do all the short films and web series that I say yes to in between my bigger projects.
Well, he's just a quitter, that's why.
And he's a wimp. He can't take it.
Yeah.
Yes, he has yet to call me back about my web short.
Okay.
There we go.
Yeah, already don't like him.
Already. Okay.
Right.
Exactly. In fact, when you're that busy, how do you even decide what you're going to do next? I mean, it sounds like you just must be getting junk mail volume of requests to be in things. How do you pick out from that pile?
Yeah.
Well, it starts with a good script for me. I try. There's people listening to this right now that'll say, yeah, you haven't read my script yet, Doug. Well, I'm trying. I try to read everything that I'm submitted, so that I can see if it's, you know, if I need to pass, I'll know why. And if it's something that's golden that I must do, then I'll know why. And the next thing would be if it's a story that I need to tell, or that I want to be a part of, that moves me in some way or makes me laugh. And then the character. Is it a character that also moves me or I can learn something from, that I feel safe inviting into my heart to play through me, that I want to get to know better? And the third thing is the director. Whose hands am I going to be in? What kind of a creative writer are we going to be on? You know. So if those things are in place, and if they don't have any money, it's an indie thing with like very little budget, I'll say yes based on those first three things if my schedule will allow it. Now, of course, money jobs have to come first, but you'll find yourself with a lull here and there, and like a month where you don't have before your next thing starts, and you can work in some of those things. And I've met a lot of brilliant young upcoming directors along the way because of this. That I would end up doing anything for it after that, because I just trust their sensibilities and their sense of humor and their timing and their storytelling.
So Guillermo del Toro calls you up tomorrow and says, "Hey, good news! I got you $20 one afternoon's work. We're doing a Pizza Hut commercial."
Would you do it?
You'd jump right.
I would.
Oh, yeah, for Guillermo del Toro, I would take a dump on the pavement if he would film it.
I agree. That guy is just amazing.
I would probably
he would turn that into something gorgeous, yeah.
Yeah, he would. It would be it would turn into an alien robot thing, and it would be kind of turd morph. Be awesome. I have a really quick question. We had a couple of your future co-stars on the Matty P. Happy Hour. And it's a project that you did called Monster School, or that you're about to do, or that you've done, and it's not come out yet. But Monster School, we had a couple of your co-stars on there. Tiffany Brower was on here, and Madison Dillon.
Oh, great!
And Yeah, tell me a little bit about Monster School.
Yeah, I have a couple projects that haven't been shot yet that I'm excited about. One of them is Monster School. The other one is Space Command, which we can talk about in a second, too. But Monster School is, I think, what the process, the place it's in right now is they're doing a web comic book of it that we're all going to voice our own characters for. The live-action movie is yet to come, and that's going to be something. If you couple Harry Potter with the X-Men First Class kind of a thing, we have an academy where we take in kids who have an inner monster that needs to be groomed and taught how to display itself. But the twist on this is that all of us who work at the school, I'm headmaster Doug Jones, and then there's also hopefully, you know, there's, oh gosh, the janitor is played by, I'm thinking it's, all my names have gone. Ah, curses. Reggie Bannister is in it, and Tony Todd is in it, and everybody plays a teacher or a gym coach or something, but we're all going by our own names. So it's as if these actors from the horror sci-fi genre are actually working at a school teaching kids how to be monsters, and it turns out that we all are monsters within ourselves as well, that we don't just play them on TV and film. So that's the concept there.
Yeah,
and it's,
kind of,
it's actually
concept.
Very family friendly and very fun, yeah. And I think
wow.
Dean Haglund, who you're having on later today, he's also, he's going to be part of Space Command, which is coming, another one that is yet to be done.
Yeah.
Space Command is an old school sci-fi property. Mark Zakri is our writer.
And he'll be on the show next week, we think, actually.
Oh, good. You're talking to Mark.
Yep.
Excellent. He'll tell you more about it. He talks fast, so keep up. But he's a genius, brilliant man, and he's created this world that brings back like the sci-fi of the olden days, of like the 50s, when you're watching things in black and white when a spaceship was on wires flying past you. It's that kind of love, but with also today's technology. So they couple that old school, we can go win the forces of evil, you'll beat them in the universe out there if we fly around fast enough and shoot enough guns. And it's that with a whole with visual effects that are just stunning. But even the style of his spaceship is very 1960s, 50s ish. And I get to play the android in this movie Space Command. My android name is Dor Nevin. And I'm sort of like an android who has taken on more human characteristics than he was supposed to. So that might cause a problem.
They always do. As soon as those
right,
you have to smack those droids back down.
Right.
Yeah, the droids are always the patsies.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Well, so I'm guessing you're going to be in costume for the droid role again.
Kind of a yes and no. They did the conceptual designs based on my face. It's based on a little bit of pasty makeup and then a headgear piece that kind of goes around the crown of my head. I'll be hairless with a shaved head and a great costume with a high collar, and it looks very very stiff and prim and put together, but it is a bit of me in there.
Oh, okay. So almost no makeup by your usual
Which is great, right? Yeah.
Well, and I was actually looking at some of your like characters and things, and you always seem to come through the mask or the makeup. You know, is that by design? Like, do you have to ask for that, or is that just the way the makeup falls on you? I mean, you can always just kind of tell it's you.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. I think that is not by design necessarily. I've certainly never requested it. I leave the design work up to those Oscar-winning artists that create all those monsters I get to wear. For me, I think it would be because I'm 6'3" and a half. I weigh 140 pounds. That's kind of a distinctive look right there, anyway.
You got it.
So when you start putting rubber on that, it's still a tall, skinny guy. And but even like my face, like I've had people tell me that Abe Sapien, even from the Hellboy movies, they see a lot of Dougie Jones in there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And on Falling Skies now, my coachee's alien. There's a little bit of Dougie Jones there, too, even though I've got these wide, bulbous eyes that are set way out, and they're golden-colored, and there's still something. I think it's the mouth. When the mouth is glued down to my own, and you can see my mouth, creating the dialogue as we go, there is a certain personality of Doug Jones that is going to come through, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's very strong in the Fawn character of Pan Lambert.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. very, very
well,
strong.
Well, thank you. It's another one of my
favorite titles. That is, I believe that's the best movie I've ever seen, to be honest
with you. It is my favorite film I've ever been in. It's the perfect movie. Yeah.
Yeah. It just blows your mind when you're yeah. watching that thing. So just
that is one you can rewatch.
Compliments to the chef on that one. You guys just kicked ass.
I thank you, and I'm sure Guillermo del Toro thanks you as well. And
he doesn't care what I think at all.
Well, of course, I think he does. You worked extra hard for that movie, though. I mean, from what I understand, you actually learned some archaic Spanish to do that.
Oh,
and I just got back from Spain with a semi-decent Spanish vocabulary, and no one understood what I was saying. So my hat's off to you for being able to deliver this this non-native dialogue, which I know you've done in a French movie, too. The
Gameport. Heroic Life, yes. That is the most difficult thing I'll ever be asked to do, is when I'm wearing a five-hour makeup application on stilts and having to deliver paragraphs of a language I don't speak. That was a mind-bender, that working on Pan's Labyrinth and Gainsbourg both. But I find that it doesn't matter if it's archaic Spanish or modern Spanish. I don't know either one of them.
Well, at least you can say that, but you've got to start reading your contracts better. Or at least check
out
Lambert.
About it. If they were only in English.
Now, speaking of the whole costume thing, though, and this is just something that's occurred to me in the past watching the Hellboy movies, because between you and Ron Perlman, who also does about half his roles in heavy makeup or full costume, did you ever just have to look at each other on the set between takes and, like, sigh?
I will give you the best sigh moment ever. After we filmed Hellboy 1, of course, it took 4 years before we were back filming Hellboy 2. On our very first day, Ron Perlman and I were being made up in chairs next to each other. Now, normally he has his own Hellboy trailer and I have my own Abe Sapien trailer for the makeup team, because our pieces are hung up and it takes a team of like three people to get us done. So we each need our own trailer because there's so many supplies that come with us. But that first day, they didn't have the second trailer up yet. So I was in with Ron, and both of our makeup teams were crowded into this makeup trailer. It's the end of the day. We've just put in, at least 12 hours, if not 18. And we're getting undone and cleaned up, and finally his face comes off with red bits and smudges and smears all over him and glue bits stuck in his hair. And I'm getting my blue bits off, and I finally can pop my face out, and there I am with, like, my hair stuck to the side of my head and blue smears on my nose and glue bits, boogers on my neck. I look at him, he looks at me, and all he said was, 6 months. 6 days a week. That's
you're
what we had ahead of us.
You're
this was, that was
six
our first,
months away at that point?
That was our first day of a six-month shoot, 6 days a week. And we were just both thinking, oh, my gosh, how are we going to survive this?
Oh, I'm sorry I didn't pay more to see that movie now.
Well,
you are underpaid.
Right. You deserve more.
I illegally downloaded it.
Oh, yeah, bless
you. Just kidding, I did not. I caught it on Netflix. That's $8 a month.
Yeah, he'll mail you some money, though, hearing this story.
Thank you. Good job.
And, I just got back from Comic-Con, and I saw the gentle giant figure of the Fawn, in the glass.
Beautiful.
There.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually going to ask, I was about to ask you, what's it like seeing yourself in statue form and you being a part of that. So, what's that whole process like?
It's rather egocentric for me. It's easy to get a big head like, yeah, I'm a statue. I'm an action figure. I'm a toy.
A $300 toy,
it was a $400 toy.
$400 toy. It is beautiful.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. Well, that is Gentle Giant's fourth, statue they've made from Pan's Labyrinth. They've done, that's their second Fawn, and they've also done two Pale Man figures. Mm-hmm. And they're all stunning and very true to life. I've also been toys and statues and action figures from the Hellboy movies, from the Silver Surfer movie, from the gentleman from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and it goes all the way back to my early days. One of my first jobs was the TV commercial campaign for McDonald's called Mac Tonight. Do you remember that Crescent Moon?
Yes, I absolutely remember that.
That sang it about. That was me in that Moonhead.
No way.
Yep. When the clock strikes, hey, 6:30, babe. No. Yeah, that was me.
You are in everything.
I just have been. Yeah, that was my first time. They turned that character into hand puppets and toys that went in the Happy Meals and beach towels, sippy cups, lunch boxes. That was my introduction into being a toy. And oh my gosh, it was really weird when you see, you know, a car drive by and their license plate frame is a Mac Tonight figure. You know what I'm saying? It's ridiculous.
Do you actually get to get like one of them for free at least? I think I have
one of everything I've been for free. Yes, I've got them all.
I'd love that. So, I'd love to take a picture of that. That is
I told the lovely Mrs. Lori, when I die or right before I die, make sure I sign every figure in this house so you can sell them on eBay.
That's excellent.
Oh, that's I hate to break away again, but now I want to get into some rumor territory. And maybe you can stop some rumors here and turn them into facts. What can you tell us about Hellboy 3?
Oh, right. There's the rumor of the day. Well, you know, rumors of Hellboy 3 got stirred up because Ron Perlman was recently in Pacific Rim with Guillermo del Toro directing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing the press tour together, and when Ron Perlman and Guillermo del Toro are sitting in the same room, just like when I and Guillermo del Toro are sitting in the same room, or Ron and I are sitting in the same room, everybody wants to know what's happening with Hellboy 3. And so on one of their early press tours, somebody asked that from the audience, and Ron said, I would love to do it. It's a favorite character I've ever played. So that got everybody Twittering and Facebooking immediately. It's going to happen, you guys! Right? So... which was, and Guillermo del Toro also would love to do a Hellboy 3. He's got the story in mind. He's always had it in mind. But Ron and Guillermo and I, even though we all want to do the movie desperately and the fans deserve a part 3, they've been waiting for a part 3. The story was left open for one. What we're missing is $200 million and a studio to back it. There you go.
Wow.
So if you have lots of rich friends. Yeah, right.
I have none. Well, and this world desperately needs another comic book movie, right? Like right now.
Right, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right.
It's been about a week
now. You should wait until, give it another 5 years, let this whole thing pass, and then, bang, you guys come out with the Hellboy 3. It's the biggest thing. That's right. That's my suggestion.
Wow.
That's a great idea.
Thank you.
Well, you sound sincere, but I also know you don't want to get back in the makeup, so I'm not going to hold it against you.
No, you know what?
I'm curious to know if you're interested in doing more comedy. I mean, you started out in a couple little things. I mean, you were even on In Living Color, apparently.
I was. I did 3 episodes of In Living Color back in the day.
And the Weird Al show, and, I mean, you played the gay robot and Nick Swartzen's Pretend Time. I mean, that's still in costume, but, I mean, are you interested in doing more?
Absolutely.
More comedy?
Yeah. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up because I just last season, the new show on ABC called The Neighbors. It's about a family that moves into a gated community in New Jersey, and they don't realize when they move in that all of their neighbors in that community are aliens from outer space who are posing as humans. So
that's just New Jersey.
Or is it just Jersey?
Wow.
The show was actually a big hit. It played right before Modern Family on Wednesday nights, and now it's going to be moving to Friday nights. They've renewed it for season 2, and I had the honor of being a recurring guest on the show. I did 6 episodes, and all of us alien people on the show go by we name ourselves after famous athletes because we think that's Earth's best people. So I go by the name of Dominique Wilkins, who was a basketball player from, like, the Michael Jordan era.
Oh, we know him. He was the best dunker up here.
Excellent. Right, so there you go. So, but, of course, I look nothing like him, as you might have guessed. So we also have Mary Lou Retton on the show and Jackie Joyner-Kersee and Larry Bird. And so it's just an absolute joy to be on such a very silly, silly show. We even did a musical episode. It was episode number 20 of season one. And that was probably the job that I could have died happy right after doing. To be on a sitcom and creating laughs and singing and dancing while doing it was just absolute dream come true for me.
Wow.
Well, we've heard you actually have a pretty impressive singing voice, and I
well,
love
I don't want to boast.
Mac the Knife. Oh no! Go ahead, give us a 4 minute song.
I'll
just put you on the spot right now.
All right, if your backup isn't there, I'll cut
you
a break.
Yeah, if you want to lose listeners, let's do that.
Well, we have five.
Now, this show doesn't have any listeners.
You have five. You want to
five?
Keep them,
but they're big. Yeah, we love them.
Yeah, my mom is not going to turn this show off no matter what you say. Now, I have a personal question, just me. I'm not sure, again, like we have no listeners. I'm not sure if anyone else saw this movie, but I personally love it. I just saw John Dies at the End about a month ago.
You and a lot of people, like the people come out of the woodwork and confess to me all the time that they've seen that movie and love it.
Oh, God. I've been running around asking people if they've seen it, and no one's even heard of it.
It tells you the ending.
Right.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. No.
Well,
it,
not
it's kind of a,
but he doesn't.
It's deceiving. Oh, wow. The title's deceiving, but John,
well, John
dies
doesn't die at the end.
Well
yeah, I don't want.
I can't say.
Spoiler alert! Come on,
Zach.
I'm not going to spoil this for you.
I'm watching it tonight. I'll confuse.
There you
but
go.
This is and another example of where you know if you've got your eyes open, you can see Doug Jones without makeup.
Without
plenty
makeup
of places.
On, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if we're talking comedy, I would say it's in the horror sci-fi genre, but it's also an extremely funny movie.
It's hilarious.
It's done by director-writer Don Coscarelli, who adapted the book John Dies at the End. And Don Coscarelli is also the same director who brought you the Phantasm movies and Bubba Hotep and The Beastmaster with Mark Singer.
Oh, I didn't know about The Beastmaster.
Yeah. Yeah,
I know. He had done Bubba Hotep.
We love Bubba Hotep in this house, sir.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
Yes, you do not have to worry about that. When I saw that, like at the Best Buy or whatever, I bought it without knowing anything about it, just by the cover.
Right. Of course you did.
Of course I did. And it was the best. Anyway, go on. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sure a lot of them got sold that way. People, what is this? Oh, and then they just think of that.
Nobody heard about
Bruce
Bubba
Campbell
Hotep.
As Elvis.
So you can't go wrong with that cover, exactly.
With a busted up crank. Anyway, go on.
Well, you know, that will happen. Speaking of that, I know you're a contortionist, too.
Well, you know, it sure is
to
written
some
about
degree,
a lot.
Anyway.
I can put my legs behind my head, have been able to since I was an early teen, and stop with the innuendos that are about to happen.
I'm actually just trying to get the vision of a 6'4" guy or whatever doing that
with his legs behind his head.
It's awful.
Well,
go on.
You know what most people ask me, of course, what most guys ask me is, well, so can you? You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. See, I didn't think about that, but now I'm curious.
I was thinking more lines of what's like the craziest position or some, you know, some crazy names I never heard of things that you got to do.
But since you asked the question, well, can you?
Oh, God.
We don't want to know.
I can't answer. Because, you know, if I say no, I can't, that means I tried. And if I say yes, I can, then I'm just a perv and I shouldn't be on the phone.
Doug, we've all tried. It's just
come on.
Far from it.
In a way, it's kind of win-win for you.
Right.
All right. Well, before
I think if the answer was yes, we wouldn't see 113 titles. It'd be more like three.
I've obviously had time for other things.
Sorry, guys. Got to go.
I'm busy tonight. I'm getting a job.
All right. Well, now, I know you're busy, and before we let you go, I just, once again into the rumor mill, we were talking to Connor Jessup about the upcoming fourth season of Fallen Skies on TNT.
Yes.
And he convinced us that the writers really didn't give him any details whatsoever. So maybe you could tell us, are they just going to kill him off and they haven't had the heart to tell him yet?
Yeah. Oh, really? Because they told all of us. I'm not sure. Why did they tell Connor?
Sure.
No. I'm going to echo what Connor said. I have no clue what's coming up for season four. In fact, I just found out myself 2 days ago that I got picked up for season four. So I have no idea in what way.
Well, you know. I haven't seen the finale yet. I've seen every other episode, so I guess you don't die. So that's good.
No, I didn't.
I just want to say before we let you go again that, and I say this to Connor over and over and over again, that show was saved, and you know, because of your character on it. I mean, it was a good show, but I was waiting for it to get into the great, you know, level. And as soon as your character shows up, I think it skyrocketed, you know, into greatness. So you are doing great work, sir. You are saving sci-fi almost by yourself.
Well, you are very, very kind. Thank you. And when you see that season finale that just aired last Sunday, you are going to see me playing multiple Volm characters in it. I play my own father in this episode. Yes.
Whoa.
So we shot it Patty Duke style.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm in.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm in.
So
all right,
I got to have conversations with myself.
That must be better than what you've just sat through.
No, you guys are delightful. Are you kidding me?
Thank you.
You're just being kind, I think. Well, in that spirit, we'll give you another 20 minutes to plug your next few upcoming projects.
Research the web series. There you go. Go to YouTube and type in research or go to researchseries.com. It's with... it's a hilarious web series with Barry Bostwick and myself, and I can't recommend it enough.
Both leads. All right. Well, thank you.
I'm going to be checking that out.
Don't forget
to
catch
that out. I need to know this.
Upcoming on The Neighbors, on Space Command, on Monster School. Look for him. Research the web series. And TNT's Falling Skies, beginning production for season 4, I think in about a month or so.
September 10th.
Caught up, people.
September 10th. We're talking to Mac the Knife himself, guys.
Mac the Knife. and if you're just tuning in, you missed out. We already heard some of the Mac the Knife song. He's not doing it again in public. He already told us.
So thank you for coming on today. This is Marquis, Grim Shea. You got Rico on the line. We are on the we just got through with Mr. Doug Jones. Thank you again for joining us. It was a real pleasure to speak with you. You are a legend in film and TV. Keep it up. You're doing the Lord's work.
Yeah. Please come back.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Doug.
All right, thanks a bunch.
So there you have it, a little early glimpse through what we've been able to pick up this past summer about the upcoming Space Command. Don't worry, it'll be sitting on the back burner, just producing and filming 3 movies back to back to back, waiting to unleash them on you somewhere in the future, and I can't wait for it. I think it's going to be great. Speaking on behalf of only myself, Grim Shea, and slightly on behalf of Matty P. Presents Saturday Morning Serials, we hope you like this little trip back, this little attempt to capture the spirit that we all remember from Saturday mornings, and I, for one, believe we're going to be able to find a little bit of it in Space Command. Please remember that. All right. Next week, we are going to try something different, but also to bring us back to those early mornings when your parents were hungover, still in bed, and you got to run out to the living room and turn on the TV real low and absolutely turn your brain off and your imagination on for 6 or 8 hours. Or maybe I was a little excessive. I would just kind of comatose over and then realize I was watching news or tennis at some point. Anyway, before tennis comes on, we're going to let you go. We hope to see you next week. Thank you for joining us, Matty P. listeners. And always remember, there is a toy at the bottom of the cereal box. You just got to get there. Good afternoon.